I'm Michael Wuchter from Wittenberg University in Ohio. I've been doing a theme of scriptural studies on the topic of epiphanies, times in the Bible when all of a sudden someone encounters God. And all of a sudden, it may be a surprise, but God is present among them. So we're going to continue that today, and the theme today is baptism by water. And the text we'll be looking at is Mark 1, 1 through 11. The reason I chose the title Baptism by Water, for some of you that have been here before, I'm approaching the Bible study a little different than normal. I'm doing it in the spirit of Haggadah, where you look at a text and then to fill in the details and bring the text into one's own life, you tell a story. Perhaps a contemporary story or a story that weaves together some other legends and stories and tries to fill in the gaps and make that the scriptural text live. And it has a long tradition in Bible studies, perhaps not our tradition, but the tradition of Haggadah. So we'll be doing that in a little while. I thought it would be, before we look actually at the text, just to say a word about beginnings. If you're a writer and you're going to write a book or perhaps an article, they always tell you that first opening section, the first sentences or the first paragraph is of critical importance, because the person is going to pick up that book and is going to read that, and if that can grasp that person, then they're going to want to stay with it and go through it. So in that opening sentence, you want to be honest, or opening paragraph, you want to be honest. You don't want to come in with some grand promises that can't be kept at the end, because then they may stay with and be angry at the end. So you want to be honest. You want to, in a sense, foreshadow what the book is going to say. You want to have images of the end from the very beginning. But you also want to grasp the person. You want to get to the point, tell them what you're going to say and how you're going to say it. Well, I thought of some of the books that are important to me and my development that I liked a lot, and one of my favorite fiction books from the past was Moby Dick. So I thought, okay, I'll look up and see how Moby Dick began. This is how Moby Dick begins. Call me Ishmael. Some years ago, never mind how long precisely, having little or no money in my purse, and nothing particular to interest me on shore, I thought I'd sail about a little and see the watery part of the world. It is a way I have of driving off the spleen and regulating the circulation. When I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses, and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, and especially when my hypus gets such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking people's hats off, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can. This is my substitute for pistol and ball. Well, that's kind of, I don't know, it grasps me, that kind of opening. But what are some of the images and symbols that are held in there? A person who is kind of, there's anger and there's something happening, unrest in that person's life, and looking for meaning and trying to go somewhere to find meaning. At the time that novel was written, people also knew a little bit more about the scripture than perhaps the contemporary secular person knows today. There are, you knew Moby Dick was a whale, and the image of Leviathan from the scripture is chaos. And you wonder, is that chaos in the sea, or is it perhaps within? And the author is saying, let's look in this book and see if the chaos is within or without in society. And so it's a journey, it's a pilgrimage. Also, probably at the time that was written, a lot of people would have known the name Ishmael, which is Hebrew, and it is, in a sense, the word means, God, hear my cry. God, hear me. So there is a theological search for God to answer in that text. So pretty powerful opening. What we're going to look at today is how the gospel writer opened Mark, because the gospel writer takes a story that is very important to him and wants people to be grasped into that story from the very beginning, foreshadowing the end. So let's look together quickly now at the beginning of the Gospel of Mark. This, verse 1, this is the good news about Jesus the Christ, the Son of God. We call our Gospels, Gospels. As you know, Gospel means good news, euangelion. This is really the only one that says this is Gospel. This is good news. That's how it begins. Because as we look at this opening part here, there would be some question whether the news to be heard is good or bad. Is God going to come to put down injustice and crush all, or is this to be something to save and to bring us together in unity? It begins by saying this is good news. It began as the prophet Isaiah had written. Now that's pretty important here. Just that word meaning it began would have been interpreted as, in a sense, Genesis. The Genesis was. Right away is tying us into the Old Testament, to the Hebrew text. We're talking about the beginning of things, and implied in this is it's going to come through you. It's beginning here. It's going to involve you at some point. It began with the prophet Isaiah. At the time of Jesus, Isaiah was one of the most popular of the prophets from the past. People read and memorized, particularly what we call Second Isaiah, the apocalyptic, the hope of the Messiah coming into the world. It was a tough time if you were a strict person to your faith, your Jewish religion. It was a time of the Roman occupation. There were a lot of compromises being asked of you. And Isaiah was a promise that God would come to lift you up. So right away here, we're being tied into this Old Testament prophet promise of Isaiah. Okay, then the author quotes, he says, from Isaiah. God said, I will send my messenger ahead of you to open the way for you. Someone is shouting in the desert, get the road ready for the Lord. Make a straight path for the Lord to travel. If we dissect this, we see that it's almost a direct quote. Of course, this is into a kind of a simple Greek, but it's almost a direct quote. If you had the Greek text of the Hebrew scripture, it's almost a direct quote from Exodus 23, verse 20, Malachi chapter 3, verse 1, and Isaiah chapter 40, verse 3. So it's kind of a conglomeration of all those promises from those various scripture. Okay, so we're tied into the promise of the past. There's some good news that's going to happen. This Jesus is already called the Christ in this text. What is happening here if you are reading this for the first time? Okay, there's going to be a fulfillment here. So John appeared in the desert, baptizing and preaching. Now some of you were at a Bible study that I did, I think 2 days ago, when we talked about the significance of the desert, the wilderness, as the place that the promise of God would be met, coming out of the wilderness. Just like the Israelites coming out of the wilderness to the promised land. God's promise of the Messiah coming out of the wilderness. So here was John appearing in the wilderness, baptizing, preaching, turn away from your sins and be baptized, he told the people, and God will forgive your sins. Right away from the beginning, there is good news in the sense of forgiveness, individual's forgiveness for a person. Many people from the province of Judea and the city of Jerusalem went out to hear John. That's kind of significant because Jerusalem was the holy city. And if we think of foreshadowing the end of the story by the beginning paragraph or so, where does Mark's gospel end? it ends in Jerusalem. You know, Mark doesn't fool around with birth narratives and childhood stories. Mark gets right to the point. And at the end, there's not a whole lot of post-resurrection appearance stories. It happens at Jerusalem with the angel saying, "Why are you looking here? Life has continued through the Christ." So we have foreshadowed now the end of the story in this beginning, in this opening. The people confessed their sins, and John baptized them in the Jordan River. Another important symbol here that I'll talk about in just a second or two. The Jordan was just jam-packed with meaning for the people in Palestine. Okay, John wore clothes. Who was this person, John? John wore clothes made of camel's hair with a leather belt around his waist. I don't know, as a kid, I always kind of envisioned that as kind of weird. But if we would look at 2 Kings 1, verse 8, we see that Elijah was dressed that same way. So right away, people would have, as soon as they heard that type of clothing, they'd think the prophet Elijah. Elijah, again, was a prophet of hope, looking for the future, that God would come again to touch the people, would be present among the people. And here is John, dressed like Elijah. Right away, people thought, you know, there's something happening here. Okay, what else do we know about John? His food was locusts and wild honey. You know, as a kid, I thought, oh my gosh, he's eating bugs, he's dressed in, you know, what a wacko person coming out of the... the food that's listed there, locusts and wild honey, are what we would call kosher food. They're in the list of approved things to eat, and you're not breaking any promises to God if you eat certain things. And locusts and honey were okay to eat, and that was good to eat. So what it's telling the people is, here is a person that has not compromised, that is not eating the meat of sacrifices to the gods of the Roman occupation. This is a person who is kept kosher, is a holy person that is coming out of the wilderness to tell us something important, to bring the message of God. In fact, the author here wanted John to be represented as the last prophet before the centering of the Christ. So this is the author's way of connecting the old creation to the new creation. Where were we?
Verse 7.
Oh, okay. Okay, so we have him coming out, this prophetic character, and he announced to the people. Now, there may have been a question, is this the Messiah? Everything seems to be right. He's coming out of the wilderness. He's has kept the covenant. He's eating the right things. He's wearing the right clothes. Is this the Messiah? Well, we got to know here from the beginning that this is the messenger. This is the last of the prophets. This is an angel, in a sense. He announced to the people, "The person who will come after me is greater than I am. In fact, I'm not even good enough to bend down and untie his sandals. I baptize you with water, but this person will baptize you with the Holy Spirit, with the very breath of God." Okay, so the messenger, the connection. What is coming now? Verse 9. "Not long afterwards, Jesus came from Nazareth in the province of Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan, the river of life. As soon as Jesus came up out of the water, he saw the heaven opening and the Spirit coming down on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, 'You are my own dear Son. I am pleased with you.'" Those words are very important because, again, if you were a person of Jewish background who knew the scriptures well, those particular words that are said as the heavens open are an adoption formula that is in the Old Testament for when a king was supposedly chosen to be the representative of God among the people. God would have a certain formula and claim this person as God's own. And this is the same formula. And just to give you an example, let me read... if I can find them quick. Well, from Isaiah, again, chapter 42, in the very beginning, the Lord says, "Here is my servant whom I strengthen, the one I have chosen, with whom I am pleased. I have filled him with my spirit, and he will bring justice to every nation." It's that same kind of formula that's happening here in the beginning of Mark. And from Psalms, the second chapter of Psalms, verse 7, "I will announce," says the king, "what the Lord has declared. The Lord said to me, 'You are my son. Today I have become your father.'" It's that same formula. So again, this is the important part of this reading. Okay, then what follows next? Now we're back to the Bible study that I did 2 days ago, if you were here then. At once the Spirit made Jesus go into the desert, where he stayed 40 days, being tempted by Diabolos, the Satan, and wild animals were there also, but angels came and helped Jesus. So we had to get also now Jesus into the wilderness to come out, and then the ministry began in Galilee, and calling the fishermen or whatever. Okay, let's in just a few minutes here try to pick up some of these symbols again and look at them in a little more detail. As I said, Mark is kind of the minimalist gospel. It's the shortest. We believe that in its present form, it's probably the oldest of the gospels. This, I believe, is the year of Mark, if you are in a congregation that follows the regular... it was last year? Okay. Well, whatever year, if it was last year, whatever year Mark is the chosen reading, you find out that when you come, it usually isn't Mark that's being read often, because when we get into Advent or whatever, Mark doesn't have any of the promise and the announcement and the birth narratives and the childhood narratives. Mark begins right with what we read and the baptism. And also, when we get into the season following Easter, a lot of the post-resurrection appearance stories, we have to go into other Gospels to get them because Mark just does not have them. But Mark, I think, gets, as we looked at today, to the heart of the issue, pulls us in and says, let's look now at the whole life, the gospel story, to the very end. Let's see, what would be... how about if we look at just briefly at John the Baptizer again? As I said, my traditional image of him was somebody with kind of a curly perm, kind of the... aurora of disarray, kind of leathery-like skin, kind of wild eyes, sharp-boned, sinewy, kind of walking through the desert, eating bugs. You really kind of wonder about this guy. But that's really an inappropriate vision of him, because if we had first heard the story in the community of Mark or Matthew or Luke, the author is very careful in that brief portrayal of John to say that this was not some wild-eyed, freaked-out hermit, but that this is one that knows the will and promise of God, one that is attempting to be faithful to God under very difficult circumstances at that time. As I said, the food that John ate, the wild honey and the locusts, were kosher. They were also very common to a desert people. I remember as a kid... our family would go into New York every once in a while for kind of a family outing, and I remember my brother going to some delicatessen on the west side and getting these grasshoppers. They were chocolate-covered grasshoppers, and he was later going to be a biology major in college, but he would break apart these, dissect them, and tell about the different body parts, and then pop them in his mouth, you know. We were just... And then it was soon after that, I mean, we had just tried to eat this stuff, and he's there eating us down, that there was a National Geographic special on TV on Bedouins. And part of that story was the importance that locusts and grasshoppers played in the life of desert people to supply protein. And this was not a weird thing to eat. This was okay to eat. And as I said, it was a kosher meal. And honey was again, an important find, a gift from nature that the desert people would often find. Appearing in the wilderness, as I said 2 days ago, is not an antisocial or psychotic behavior to all of a sudden be out in the wilderness. It was an area that was considered to be uncontaminated by religious impurity. It was a place where often a holy person would go for meditation, for spiritual reflection and renewal. And we talked about Holden kind of taking on a desert feeling in the sense of a place to come for renewal and meditation.
That also his family background and basis was...
What, well, for John, you mean?
The desert, now the wilderness for John.
Yeah, we don't know...
Because, okay. You know, my understanding of it, or the forecoming of John the Baptist, the birth of John alone, you know, was rather miraculous. And he came out of a family that, in and of itself, you know, lived in the wilderness for the most part and were nomadic somewhat.
Yeah.
And therefore, that betrayal, I mean, the way he came out with his camel hair clothes and, you know, very simplistic, very down-to-earth lifestyle, coming from his parentage also, would be perfectly acceptable in the time and place.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. A lot of the traditions about John developed after the tradition that Mark has, and that's, you know, that's true to the tradition that came out. I have a feeling that some of the people that first heard Mark didn't know that background. All they knew is what Mark told us in that first section there. But the little clues in there, like you said, people knew they didn't have to be told about the desert and what, you know, what he was wearing, what he was eating, what he was saying. Tied in all these other symbols.
Mark, what was his qualification?
Well, we're not sure. Mark, the Markan community, it seemed to be, there's some things that he mentions that can be tied into a particular period of time. There was a certain persecution that was occurring in AD 64, so we think it was about that time. We can tell that the Markan community was people that understood Jewish background, but could have been some converts, and also had been people that were not what you would call strict Jews, so far as following, you know, they had been involved with other traditions and things, but they knew the stories. And so that's the kind of people that Mark was writing to.
May have written this from hearing stories rather than from actually having lived in contact.
The thought is that there were saying sources of Jesus and traditions about what Jesus said from people who were probably with Jesus, collected these. They were oral stories. Remember, often people assumed that the second coming perhaps would happen soon. So there was not a great desire to publish a book, because why do this, you know? But eventually to spread the word. And Mark is really one who is beginning to move out and speak to those that were not necessarily Jewish Palestinians. And that's why he has to explain the customs a lot, because some of the people weren't quite sure what the background was. So we think now that at some point they wanted to get this together into the good news. And this is like one of the early attempts of it. The community of Luke and the community of Matthew had an early Markus in front of them, and so they incorporated most of Mark into their stories too, along with some other sayings, and to embellish the story. So, the desert was a place to go for meditation and spiritual renewal. It was also a place where a person would go as a refugee if they did not want to participate in the Roman occupation and what was required of them in terms of taxes, in terms of a census, things like that. If they felt that that was idolatry, they would be like they'd flee into the wilderness and hide back in the caves, and there was communities back in a way that was outside of the Roman touch. You know, sort of like someone fleeing the United States and going to Canada because they didn't want to be, you know, but there was a sense of purity there that they had kept that. As I said before, 2 days ago, the wilderness had the image of Exodus, where the people were delivered out of slavery in Egypt. They went into the wilderness but were cared for by God in the wilderness, and then emerged from the wilderness into the Holy Land. The promise was fulfilled. And then according to tradition, of course, the Messiah is one who will emerge from the wilderness. So you have all this baggage going on with the image of the desert. And then one more important thing that I just wanted to mention to you is the Jordan River itself, because we have this symbol of the desert, but now it's tied into the symbol of the Jordan River. How many of you have been to Israel and seen a couple people, a few people, a lot of people? The Jordan River, sometimes if you come right into Israel and you're kind of tired from jet lag and you come down to the Jordan River and you go, here is the Jordan River, because I don't know, I just had this feeling as a kid, the mighty Jordan River. I mean, you know, just the power, and it seems like you're pulled to the Jordan River. And if you're from this part of the country and you see these mountain rivers just steaming out of the mountains with all that power and stuff, and you're ready for something like that. And the Jordan River, I mean, you can walk across it. I mean, and it's kind of like green in places, and it's small. It's tiny. In fact, I think the first time I was there, we went over it, you know, and a couple people were saying, well, when are we going to get to the Jordan? Well, you missed it. I mean, we went over it. But if you get a chance and you get up into the mountains, and the first time I saw the Jordan was we were in what is now the country of Jordan, and we went up into the Jordanian Heights, where you look over the Jordan River Valley, and it happened to be a very clear day, and you could even see the towers of Jerusalem off on one side and the Dead Sea off to the left and kind of the mountains where the Sea of Galilee is off to the right there. So you have this sort of, you can see for almost 25 miles in this bowl. And it is, despite the Israeli irrigation and the miracle of irrigation that they're doing in that valley, it is desert. I mean, you get up there and you look and it is brown and dead. And snaking through the middle of this is a river of green. I mean, it's like a snake of green. It is life that flows through this desert. And so the Jordan River, for the people that lived in that area, was the symbol of life. I mean, here was water that allowed the desert to spring into life. Today, the irrigation, as I mentioned, they're bleeding off a lot of the water of the Jordan. But even at the time of Jesus, it was not a big river. But hugging the banks would be this kind of green vegetation. The Jordan was where you would also come perhaps to gather up water in your water jugs to take back to your family, to bathe your children, to water your own little gardens. This was what gave life. So here we have the baptism in the midst of this. Jesus coming, we're not sure what form it was in, whether water was poured over or dunked into this water or whatever, but coming out of the barrenness of the desert and up out of this comes life. All that with the hope of the Messiah. And then that sense of Genesis, a beginning of which you are a part of the story. You're tied into this. I mean, you know, later on in the Christian church, I mean, it's your baptism too that is all a part of this same story that you're living. Okay, any other thing you want to, that I overlooked that's important about that story? And yeah.
This is just enough, but the wild honey that they talk about in the locust is a complete diet. The wild honey included the pollen, I suppose, which was included almost everything necessary for life, including the minerals and the vitamins and everything else that was included. So it was a complete protein, and it was essential. And of course, there are many who are advocating it today.
Yeah, that's neat. So it's a good hiker's mix, I guess, with the honey and locusts, and you're all set. The story, the Haggadah part of this Bible reading, is perhaps a little different. If you've been to some of my other sessions, a little bit different. It's in some ways more traditional. In some ways, it's a series of images that I have in regard to what baptism means for me, and I hope it'll trigger some experiences in your own life to tie in with baptism that I think are all held very nicely in Mark's beginning to the gospel. This again is a story in transition. I was working on this right before breakfast, and again I've scribbled things in here, and I hope I can read them. I don't think it's finished yet, so maybe you could help me finish it. Baptism by Water. The reason I use that title, it's geared for a secular audience in a way, and usually the title is more Baptism by Fire. You know, you go through life, and whereas I think water is the symbol that I think holds the power of life that I want to capture. The sea has a way of swallowing time. It is only human commitment that makes distinctions and divides the moment into responsibility and genuine celebration. I had to soon leave the beach and its inlet rocks for the short ride to the old family church for my nephew's baptism, which was scheduled to occur in less than an hour's time. And the cold of the moment did penetrate deep into chest and lungs, yet there was some haunting attraction to the spectacle before me, which kept me braced on the rocks with my back to the driving wind. It was a late December beach, which seemed to lose its confidence that warmth would ever will to return. A white, churned, hysterical sea smashed into the jetty before me, caught the wind, and was transferred into a fine, hazy mist that quickly froze and glazed the rocks with a thick, white, translucent skin through which one could still see the stone's fine black sole. And in those fleeting moments, when sunlight escaped through the gray clouds and struck the rocks, the ice rendered a fine white vapor. Wisps of eternal energy, like the smoke of votive incense, escaped from the heart of the stone and was offered back to both the wind and the waves. It was a true winter beach. As the tide moved from high to low, lured towards other beaches and rocky inlets in France, some of the receding water would be captured by the cold and frozen in place, forming stiff blue bands on the sand that marked and mirrored the retreating surf. Higher on the beach, one could dig with a broken wooden piece of bleached snow fencing into the stiff sand and discover a layer of last week's snow, which was differentiated from the sand not by its crystalline structure, but only by its fine textured sense of white. It was a winter water world of ice and vapor and stiffness and agitated liquid, all in harmony with the sharp cold. Yet I remained a little bit longer, standing precariously on the glazed rocks of the jetty, and watched as ice-coated men below me silently dragged the dark water of the Manasquan Inlet for human bodies. A few days earlier, an 87-foot, 175-ton steel-hulled scallop boat, the Liberty, with a crew of nine, started on what is called at the shore in December a 21-day Christmas outing. Starting in mid-month, the fishing trawler would be at sea for 3 weeks, harvesting scallops and missing the holidays with their families. Christmas morning, awake before dawn, rocking in the swells, no firm foundation like every other morning on the sea, these men would have dressed in rubber and wool and greeted each other with simple words that perhaps affirmed a Christmas hope for peace. One, maybe two of them would have said a silent prayer, and all would have had thoughts of decorated trees and children and warm houses, maybe their own, maybe from their own past or what they wished had been their past. And then they would have stepped over the steel lip that guards the opening of their circular doorway from the sea wash on the deck, and they would have stepped out into the cold resistance of a Christmasless wind and onto the glazed wooden deck of the Liberty, to chop ice off the wench and cables, and then drag the ocean bottom for more scallops. But this particular Christmas outing was cut short. 35 miles east of the inlet on which I now stood, at the onset of a fierce, compact, mid-December storm, the waterproofing seam and the insulating packing around the ship's rudder post silently burned away, and seawater soon flowed undetected into a lower compartment of the vessel. an old rusted bilge pump malfunctioned in the depth of the night, and masked by the churning sea and the dark rage of that early hour, the water crept higher up inside the whole wall of the lazarette, an aft compartment which contained the steering and rudder mechanism. The Liberty rocked low in the water as if its belly was already full of scallops and yearned to come home. When the sea within was detected, the captain turned the stern of the ship into the 45-mile-an-hour wind, and at the first break of morning light issued a calm call for assistance on the wireless, which then in turn brought a Coast Guard helicopter and an auxiliary pump the size of a barrel, which was lowered by swaying frozen cable onto the deck. But the new pump was insufficient to ultimately remove the increasing volume of inrushing water. The captain then made the decision that held deep within the realm of destiny the weight of final defeat. As the storm raged on, each moment increased the jeopardy of the Liberty. The decision was made to attempt to bring the boat into the shelter of the river mouth, passing through the inlet, even in the midst of the mixed chaos of wind and wave and rocks. At 1 p.m., when the tide was at its highest level and there would be the least destabilizing current in the inlet channel, the two 54-foot-high wing-like outriggers on each flank of the boat, which had been placed straight out in dragging position, were raised, sacrificing a lower center of gravity, but offering less of a chance for them to be struck by the waves that guarded the inlet mouth. A wave catching the poles and cables of an outrigger could easily swing the ship into the rocks. The water-heavy ship, struggling on, riding dangerously low in the water, its outriggers held high as if in surrender, entered between the gray, outstretched arms of the inlet jetties. Just when a 20-foot wave, its crest fraying into chaos, exploded into the Liberty and spun her into a quarter turn, shifting the deck top dredges to starboard rail. Broached, its port side was now a sacrificial offering to the angry surf. The trailer only had to wait a few seconds longer, when it seemed in slow motion. As it was later described by a horrified eyewitness, a larger, moving mountain of dark water smoked into the ship, and the Liberty just rolled over. It was not a violent, sudden, jagged expression marking the end of order, but rather a calm, deliberate last breath, a final gasp, a resolution. The Liberty just rolled over. Witnesses who had parked at the road along the inner inlet rocks to sit in their cars and eat their sandwich or yogurt lunches and watch the empowered waves meet stone in explosions of spume witnessed through their windshields death instead. Five members of the crew managed to hang on with fear locked in frozen hands to the capsized hull or onto floating debris, keeping heads above ice water, struggling, willing only to keep breathing, to keep living. And as a Christmas miracle of sorts, they were pulled from the cold chaos and revived, warm breath forced into their chests. But two others were pulled out of the sea without a pulse, their lungs filled with salt water and diesel fuel. And the other two, one 18 years old, the other 24, just disappeared. They sank into the watery abyss, sucked down and swallowed by the sea. And the water still holds them tightly and wills to transform them back into sea salt and sand. And so thick-coated, ice-glazed men now drag the waters with cables and hooks and search the capsized hull, the mast-like superstructure of the outriggers embedded 20 feet down in the inlet mud and sand. The search I was now witnessing was a hushed ceremony that held no hope of any victory. When the time was finally correct and I could disengage due to the necessity of a promise made in artificial time, I carefully jumped from the rocks onto the beachside sand and walked silently up the sloping shoreline to weave through snow fences and feelings of loss and fear. But for some primal reason, not really wanting to escape from the sight of death, and yet not wishing to be late for my infant nephew's baptism in a communion of others. The white colonial-style church with a soaring steeple capped by a green copper weather vane, its arrow having pointed away from many a storm. The church was built in 1823, guarded on each side by massive holly trees and mature boxwood that had witnessed many of those years. The church was located on a corner facing Main Street, a tree-lined avenue which ran only about 1 mile straight east before abruptly ending on the beach. My home was directly across a side street from the church building. The first mate of the Liberty and his family just across Main Street in a modest house facing the front of the church. The first mate was one of those bodies pulled lifeless from the sea on that Arctic day. Approaching the church from the inlet on this baptism day, my vision seemed affixed alone to the first mate's home. Even on gray, wind, and spray-thick days such as this day, one could still hear clearly the foghorn at the inlet, where the icemen were at this very moment still looking for the first mate's dead colleagues. Behind the church stood a small, weather-worn 19th-century cemetery, which contains a number of tomb markers with no bones beneath. There were never any bones beneath. A name, dates, perhaps a brief quote or Bible verse were carved into the now worn and weathered stone, along with the words, "Lost at Sea." During the long summer months, when I was perhaps 11 or 12 years old, that age before being tied down by the responsibility and time frame of a real summer job along the beach, and following an afternoon of riding waves on inflated canvas and rubber surf mats, and after the evening meal of perhaps baked bluefish and steamed corn, and on those days when my baseball team was idle, I would often go out into the backyard with a little bucket of beat-up golf balls and an incomplete set of Gene Saracen autographed Woodshank golf clubs and fantasize about winning the Westchester Open. With a pitching wedge or 9-iron, I would attempt to loft the ball over our side street and its power lines and over the church's narrow parking lot and into a small open spot of grass and weeds in the middle of the cemetery. It was not a patrolled, fenced-in, antiseptic cemetery sprouting plastic flowers and artificial hopes, but rather a genuine, non-pretentious, overgrown, death-marked graveyard. I spent many warm summer evenings wandering around the quiet of that space, hunting my golf balls and reading the inscriptions on the pock-marked, lichen-covered tombstones. I thought of people who had stood in the same place yet a different time, perhaps over 100 years earlier, when the soil before the headstones was freshly disturbed, or at least before some of the graves. What were their thoughts? Sorrow, honor, pride, inner struggles confronting the inevitability or the loss or the waste of death that was so presently marked by the stone? There were a number of gravestones engraved with names that held symbols of hope and will. Thomas Jefferson Sorensen, George Washington McGreevy. What hopes did their parents have for these persons at their birth? What hopes were fulfilled, were altered, were shattered? And probably the most striking feature of the cemetery was that it was littered with the graves of children. In fact, the vast majority of headstones in this cemetery marked the graves of little persons much younger than I was when I walked around the tombstones with my sneakers, shorts, and pitching wedge. And I always walked quietly and gently in that special space, but also under the assumption that these children did appreciate my visit and would have gladly assisted me in my search for lost golf balls and turtles if they could have been released just for a moment or two. But what most centered and worried one's thoughts were those markers of empty graves. One of the largest objects in the whole cemetery was a granite obelisk set in place to memorialize the life of Oscar E. Pierce, 27 years of age, who was lost along with his fishing boat and whole crew in the great storm of October 13th through the 16th, 1889. Most of the graves in this cemetery were marked with slabs of weathered limestone, stone formed from the microscopic crushed frameworks of ancient creatures of the sea. The stone is their bodies and is their mass tomb. But the life of Oscar E. Pierce was commemorated with words etched into the polished black granite. The sea held all the bodies of this remembrance. I tried to envision this funeral or memorial service, the people gathering together. Was the marker, when the marker was first planted in the soil, was there the sound of a foghorn to be heard in the cold, damp, and gray, thick gray air? Was the widow and the children of the sailor in tears standing on this very spot? Was there an empty casket used for the funeral to serve as a symbol of conclusion, even though the captain's body probably left with the Gulf Stream up towards Long Island? Would the children now also work on the inlet fishing fleet, or would their or could their destiny be different now following the death of their father? This adolescent experience of grave wandering was more than just an example of being overly sentimental concerning the remains of long-dead children and old sea captains. Rather, in that sacred space, I experienced a journey of identification with past parents and siblings and friends, now long gone themselves. But I was cognizant that at some distant yet tangible time in that same place, they too had been hoping and fearing and caring and planning. And as I wondered and read and imagined, I did identify with their inner striving and craving for a unity and a peace and for some bold answer or word to the meaning of it all. Perhaps it was here that I first met the ice men, dragging for bodies in the windswept confusion of my human origins. My early cemetery wanderings were a part of that process of encounter with my own future of love and loss as we together walk through the life in community. The cemetery sang with the recalled life of real people, with their limitations and yet in their totality. Certainly not just the point of death, but a miniature community of people reviewing the facts and plans and value of their life and their quest for purpose in the face of birth and death. That cemetery would have been a rather melancholy place for a young boy to wander around in my continual search for lost golf balls, except for the fact that the gravestones were in the shadow of a steeple of a weather vane crowning a church building where people came through the years and still came together for the search, within the reassurance of the shadow of the church. And the tombstones were not just etched with names and dates, but also with words of love and faith commissioned by grieving and hoping relatives and friends. Delicate markings of crosses and flowery Victorian words of assurance about continuation, about the care for these unique individuals who were and are, even now, when the words on the stone are worn beyond recognition. And I was the only visitor who tried to remember, slashing at the covering vines and weeds with a rusting pitching wedge. Cared for close and held even especially now, I was sure. It was not just tombs and tears, but there was something frozen in the old stone and entwined in the ivy of that cemetery that held power and a life which is not now just limited by the application of my mind or by the will or hope of any other cemetery wanderer or anyone else who walks the beach of our life and perceives the restless sea as only an indifference birthing ground and a mass grave. As I drove down Main Street, my eyes moved from his house, the white shingled house with the wraparound porch of the first mate of the Liberty, and the present pain of genuine loss that must have encompassed its interior at that very moment. And my eyes shifted to the open door of the white wooden church that formed a primary part of my home and my soul at the shore. A few minutes later, with words, water was poured onto baby cousin Kevin's bald head, and it ran down into his eyes and into his mouth, and startled, he grasped for breath. He wanted to breathe. He wanted to live. Some of the water splashed off Kevin's head and onto my adolescent daughter, who was standing almost directly under him, peering up at the mystery of water and word. And she cherished this involvement and connection of the water, darkening spots on her light blue dress. It was very real and present. It touched her too. It touched all of us. My nephew Kevin was welcome sputtering into the water world of death and life and more. It was a fine, watery reference point. Kevin cried out, red-faced and wet, and was held more securely by his mother. And from the water of the womb to this water holding words of a willed compassion and community for all, forever, Kevin was held tight, and his crying stopped. The substance of water and of mind and body are only temporary and can be quickly broken down into other momentary stages of physical reality, such as salt and vapor and sand. The liberty is here, certainly, and the grace of baptism extends even to the frozen inlet and to the depths and tides that swallow bodies. Through a window of the church, I could see the granite grave obelisk peeking over a shiny leafed holly tree. The sound of the inlet foghorn penetrated through the very walls of the old but still living church. And words were spoken and promises kept, not painless, not immortal, but an offered gift that is beyond ultimate conclusion. And cousin Kevin, wet-headed and wide-eyed, caught his breath again and was ready, all ready for living. Any thoughts of your own, baptism or symbols of baptism or tying into Mark with, in the midst of the confusion and death of the Roman occupation and the pain of life at that time, came the River Jordan, bringing life. And yet, what of continuation beyond? What of Messiah? What is our hope? And baptized in the river by all the hope of the Old Testament was Jesus as the Christ. And we're carried to the end of the story. And the angel says at the tomb, why are you searching here? Christ is risen. And you are part, or can be part, of that story. In a sense, in your own baptism. Any thoughts or...
Where's the, I don't know the quotation that in Paul, but he said, but we are baptized into Christ's death also. When we are baptized, we're also baptized into death,
yeah,
as well as life.
Yeah.
But I can't remember that. I can't remember.
Well, situation. I think you remember what's important.
Yeah.
I think that's good because, you know, Mark wants to bring us into the story. It's the story of Jesus. And as the story develops after the baptism, the suffering of not only the people around Jesus, Jesus came as a healer, but Jesus is suffering too, particularly Mark. This is true incarnation. This is human being, one who can suffer, both physically, emotionally, mentally. Diabolos comes back to tempt, and you wonder why. And Mark is one that has Jesus wondering why. It's not like when we get into Luke, where Luke is saying, Jesus really knew, but he was kind of doing this to identify with the people. Mark, for Jesus in Mark, was one who was suffering with the people. And that's, you know, the resurrection was, our resurrection is with Jesus also. So that's, you know, that's good. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's such a wonderful
description. Of John the Baptist.
Ask him.
I want you to describe Jesus. Such a wonderful description. John the Baptist. Can you try to describe Jesus?
Oh. I think, well, I what Mark wants to do is to draw you into the story of good news. And so right after the baptism, and when Jesus comes out of the wilderness of the temptation, then we learn about Jesus. And what is the story that we hear about Jesus? He gathers together the apostles. That's the next part of the story. And who are these apostles? Are they people of power and wealth or whatever? They're fishermen. They're rejects. He gathers them together in a community of caring. And then he enters the ministry of healing and going to people that are normally rejected, or people that society at the time would say they're deserving what they're getting. And they're the ones that Jesus eats with and touches and puts the arm around. And I think they're the images that begin to portray what this Jesus is, along with his humanity, along with the suffering and the pain and the questioning that's a part of that story. And then resurrection. So
is the fact that he doesn't describe what Jesus wore and all that sort of thing significant to the extent that he dressed like
or his eyes or his hair?
Yeah. I think maybe. I think maybe we can more easily see Jesus around us today. Maybe we can see Christ in others easier without having it described about what Jesus was looking at. That's interesting. As a new creation, there really isn't a picture of what Jesus looked like. I think it's fascinating that if you get back artwork in the church, like we were talking about before, there wasn't really artwork in the beginning, primarily because Christians were often poor and couldn't afford artwork, and secondly because they didn't feel a need to collect stuff, to gather things together and to save things. I mean, that wasn't necessary. So it really wasn't until almost a century later that we have found artwork remains. I'm sure the earliest artwork was probably very fragile. But the earliest pictures of Jesus, he never had a beard, for example. And I think our Sunday school image of Jesus is always with a beard. The earliest artwork never had a beard. Now, that doesn't mean what Jesus looked like. I mean, but just different images. And one of the things that I have at home is kind of a collection of pictures of Jesus, many of which are Christmas cards that people send to me. And if you get a Christmas card from Christians in Japan, Jesus is Japanese. And if you get a Christmas card painted by Native Americans, Jesus is a Native American. Central America, there, and I think that's the beauty of it.